May the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts always be acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our redeemer.
Tears are our first words. How does a baby get attention?
Cries. More cries, more attention it's going to get.
It's really the way they can communicate. Is there anything that gets a baby more attention than tears? Is there anything that can command complete immediate devotion more than a torrent of tears? Is there anything that makes adults feel more dismal, daunted, desperate than the wailing of an infant? You always want to go and try to find out what's wrong or take care of the baby. Our baby's tears can bring us to tears as well. In earlier cultures, the tears of mourners were gathered into something called a lacrimatory or tear catcher, a specially designed, created container for human tears of grief or sometimes of joy. In fact, a company has brought them back and is now selling them online. So if you're real interested, you can go to tearcatcher.com and you can buy contemporary tear bottles. They actually give you instructions as to how to put the container near your eyes to catch the tears. Now, I know it sounds funny, but it's going back to this ancient tradition of collecting tears. They have all kinds of prices. It's interesting. This style is individually hand-blown and flame-worked by a talented glass artist in the United States. Splashes or swirls of colored glass and a 24-karat gold luster band around the upper rim embellish most of the contemporary bottles. And as I said, tearcatcher.com, if you're interested. Mourning tears were believed to have extreme powers of solace, sustenance, of spiritual healing. There were beautiful, delicate, lacrimatory tear bottles for women and more masculine cigar-shaped tear bottles for men. Traditionally, all were designed with an evaporation chamber. When the last of the gathered tears finally evaporated, the official mourning period was over. In Roman times, women were paid to cry into tear bottles so that as many filled bottles as possible could accompany the extensive mourning processions that befitted any important, powerful figure. In typical Roman fashion, sounds like Texas, more was always better, whether one was dead or alive. Even the most humble burial ceremony involved the presence of paid mourners. In Jewish culture, the bare minimum required 2 flute players and a professional wailing woman. Anything less was an insult to the family name. The grief industry in the first century, like that of the 21st century, was big business. Have you noticed that as the economy has recessed, the number of ads for life insurance are on the rise? In the face of an uncertain economic climate, unstable global relationships, such as in Syria, catastrophic environmental scenarios, and butt-headed political stalemates, there is always one thing that remains certain: death. You can always bank on death showing up. The grief industry never has a downturn. When Jesus finally arrived at Bethany, the first century grief industry was already well represented. The Jews who came down from Jerusalem to console Martha and Mary undoubtedly included many professional mourners, musicians, and trained tear producers. The family had purchased a costly cave tomb for Lazarus. His body had been carefully wrapped with burial linens and anointed with the oils and spices commonly used to hold the odor of death at bay as much as possible. Although both Martha and Mary confessed the conviction that had Jesus been present at Lazarus' sickbed, he would not have died, both sisters had now resigned themselves to their brother's death. They had given themselves over to grief. They had abandoned all hope. They were prepared for tears. They were prepared for separation from their beloved brother. They were prepared for the finality of death. They were not prepared for what Jesus was bringing them. They weren't prepared for a miracle. They weren't prepared for hope. They weren't prepared for resurrection. They weren't prepared for new life. Last year marked the 25th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. Those of you remember seeing the photos, the TV pictures of the people taking the wall down. That most hated symbol of repression, that most revered symbol of communist power, came down after decades of being one of the most feared symbols in the world. It came down not in a hail of bullets and butchery. It came down through the unstoppable power of hope, the hope of saints. Who can forget images of East Germans, mostly young people standing on top of the wall, waving flags, hammers, and screwdrivers, and tearing the wall down with their bare hands? And when the wall came down, and the communist regime in East Germany came down, the domino effect seemed to take hold. And then the Soviet Union came down, and the communist regimes in Eastern Europe, came down too. That's right, you heard me. Instead of an underground army of freedom fighters launching guerrilla attacks on the concrete barrier, the force that finally toppled the Berlin Wall was made up of nothing more than candles and prayer. That's right, candles and prayers. On the 20th anniversary, churches in what was once East Germany celebrated the peaceful revolution, now known as the Protestant Revolution. On the 9th of November, 1989, the first plink of hammers could be heard at Checkpoint Charlie, the icon of the Cold War. On this 20th anniversary, too, of the fall of Berlin, this tearing down was celebrated by tourists at Snack Point Charlie Cafe and at the Death Strip, where 136 people were shot to death trying to escape from East to West Berlin. And then on that site, they built a chapel of reconciliation. And that chapel holds weekday services in remembrance of those members of the communion of saints who helped to bring down the walls of hatred and prejudice. It may be worth a minute to retell the story of how the wall came tumbling down. By the spring of 1989, the people of East German cities like Leipzig no longer could take totalitarianism. What they had basically done was, if you remember, there was this big wall, and if you were in East Germany, you were really kind of suppressed. The West Germans had a democratic way of government, and basically they closed all the churches. There weren't many churches left in East Germany. The state tried its best to annihilate all of them. The state did let a few churches remain visibly open to prove to the rest of the world that they had freedom of religion. The current Chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel, or as we say, Angela Merkel, is the daughter of a pastor of one of those Lutheran churches, something I wasn't aware of. But most churches became museums, libraries, and office buildings. The magnificent Gothic church on the campus of Leipzig University was an embarrassment to the regime, so it was blown up and replaced with a gray administration building. Now, this is interesting. No Christian could hold party membership, which meant no Christian could hold a state job, no Christian could teach, no Christian could work in hospitals, no Christian could hold offices in high levels of business and industry, no Christian parents could send their children to the best schools. Yet in April of 1989, there was an ecumenical assembly in East Germany with delegates from whatever Reformed and Lutheran churches were left. That assembly of Lutheran and Reformed Christians did something that took a huge amount of courage. They demanded freedom. They demanded freedom of religion and speech. They demanded freedom of travel, freedom to form groups and clubs. One of their leaders, Bishop Christopher Kaler, says that the ecumenical assembly was the handwriting on the wall. Then it began. After work, people started flocking to those few Protestant Revolution churches. There they sang hymns, prayed, lit candles, and then left the church to march silently in the streets. I wish I could show you the YouTube video, which shows how the people are going out more and more in the streets with candles. And the soldiers are all there with guns, the Soviets and East Germany, ready to shoot them down. And then basically what happened is they put their guns down, and they were given candles, and they joined the whole procession.
The first march of 15,000 people was in Plauen 25 years ago, the 1st of October, when Horg Schneider types and distributes 120 flyers. This inspired other cities like Leipzig to demonstrate a very risky business in the German Democratic Republic 26 years ago. In Leipzig, at the huge Nikolai Kirche, hundreds and then thousands of East Germans gathered, lit candles, marched into the town square, and filled the streets. Gradually, the crowds grew in size until they filled the road, ringing the city. The city of Leipzig was surrounded. The city of Leipzig was under siege by prayers, candles, and silence. A member of the Politburo, Horst Snitterman, said later, "We were prepared for everything, but not candles and prayers." One of the worst, most oppressive regimes the world had ever seen, the communist regime of East Germany, quietly and quickly collapsed. What was it that a member of the Politburo said? "We were prepared for everything, but not candles and prayers." It had been easy for the East Berlin Army to shoot or capture anyone who tried to sneak out to freedom in the West. But candlelight processions and all-night, all-day prayer vigils at the wall weren't so easy to deal with. Prayers and candles undermine the powerful. Candles and prayers unnerved the armed forces. Candles and prayers unraveled the blanket of fear. The Eastern Bloc had prepared for riots. The East Germans had prepared for economic boycotts. East Germany had prepared for violence. The Politburo politicians had prepared for outside political pressures. But they were not prepared for candles and prayers. By the time the first person finally took the first swing of a pickaxe at the Berlin Wall, by the time the first piece of concrete crumbled into the crowd, by the time the barrier had been broken, the prayers and candles on both sides of the Berlin Wall had reduced it to insignificance, to a non-entity, long before the bulldozers cleared away the last of the rubble. The miracle of the resurrected Christ undermined, unnerves and unravels the powers of doubt, death, and despair that once defined the human condition. And we, saints, ordinary people like you and me, are never fully prepared for the power of the presence of Christ when it breaks into our lives. The Philistines were prepared for everything, but not a small boy, stones in a sling. Pharaoh's army was prepared for everything, but not a wave of water. Jericho was prepared for everything, but not a marching band and a trumpet. Martha was prepared for everything, but not a brother brought back to life. Martha would have had Jesus hold his nose to block the stench of death. Jesus had Martha open her arms to receive back her brother in life. How many of us are like Martha, preparing for everything, but not the power of candles and prayer? I think of a teenager who has had a few drinks too many and calls his parents because he's afraid to drive home. He is prepared to be really punished and lashed out at. But instead, he gets a prayer of thanks and a hug from grateful parents that he called home rather than drive home. I think of a husband who arrives unexpectedly on the porch of his estranged wife, a wife who is prepared for anger and divorce papers, and instead is offered flowers and floral apologies. What in your life is prepared for the worst? Think about it. But not candles and prayers. So this is what I'd like us to do this week. Thinking of All Saints Day. Be that person. You and I need to think about being that person with prayers and candles. Be that saint who forgives, who isn't judgmental, who helps those less fortunate, who isn't selfish, who isn't jealous, who's humble, and who thinks of others before themselves. That's the stuff that saints are made of. That's the stuff that Jesus calls you and me to be, a saint of God. Happy All Saints Day.